Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. If these past few months have proved anything, it's just how interconnected and close our world is. A novel infectious disease that originated half a world away 6 months ago is now affecting every aspect of our lives globally today. Look back a decade. Just over a decade ago, a mortgage-based security bubble burst in the United States, and a deep global recession ensued all over the world. We need to know more about the world generally, at a time when our educational system, our jobs, and our lives require more and more specialization. My guest today is a veteran diplomat, a prominent voice on American foreign policy, who in his latest book offers a concise, essential history of the world, the issues and concerns of each region of the world, and the challenges and opportunities this current age offers. Dr. Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He says he wrote The World, A Brief Introduction, as just that, an introduction to becoming a better global citizen, more globally literate, and as a way to make better sense of the daily news cycle and the issues that confront us as Americans. He offers no prescription, just a view of the world and the challenges that face 21st century life. Dr. Haass has been the president of the Council on Foreign Relations for 17 years. Prior to that, he served as a director of policy planning for the State Department, where he was a principal advisor to Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2013 and 2014, he served as the chair of the multi-party negotiations in Northern Ireland that helped promote peace and conflict resolution there in that land. And he has also served as a special assistant to President George H.W. Bush and was a senior director for Near East and South Asian Affairs on the staff of the National Security Council. His new book, The World, A Brief Introduction, is published by Penguin Press. Richard Haass, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
One of the central questions of your book is whether the rules-based systems that were created at the end of World War II, which have admittedly been fraying over the past 15, 20, 30 years, will still be relevant well into the 21st century. Of course, it's difficult to stand back at this particular moment with a global pandemic, but what impact will the coronavirus pandemic have on this question? Do you think it will have an impact?
Well, the biggest impact of the virus will probably be for the next several years to absorb tremendous resources, whether the resources are the time and attention of policymakers or obviously financial resources. It will lead countries, including our own, to turn inward. And the problem is that the lesson of the pandemic is the dangers of being turned inward, that the world can be a dangerous place, that globalization is a reality. Things come at you, be they viruses or terrorists or climate change. So we need to be turned outward. We need to be focused on these threats. We need to work with others to meet them. And again, the biggest danger of the pandemic, it seems to me, is it makes it that much harder for countries, for governments, for political leaders to give these international challenges the time and effort they require.
Do you gather through any sense that countries see that belief that turning inward will actually hurt them in the long run? Or do you think that the natural inclination is for governments to naturally turn inward in a situation like this?
I think it's their natural inclination. It's not the right one, though. Again, the principal takeaway of something like this ought to be that nothing stays local for long. In this case, it began in a city in China that few heard of, and it's had the effect where, over 90,000 Americans now have lost their lives, and trillions of dollars of wealth have been destroyed, and 20-25% of our workforce is unemployed. So logically, the lesson ought to be that, if anything, we ought to pay more attention to what goes on in the world and what could affect us from the world. But politics and history are not always about logic. So what we'll need are either leaders who see this or people will have to demand it. One of the reasons I wrote this book was to increase the appreciation and awareness of the world and why it matters and how much it matters. And what I'm hoping is that citizens, as they get better informed, will ask more questions and ultimately demand that their political leaders pay more attention to the world in ways that will also look out for the interests of every American.
Is it your fear that we'll resurrect hard borders that used to be governing the world in the 19th century, early 20th century, 18th century?
Look, I'm in favor of hard borders when it comes to stopping invading armies. But I think the lesson of something like viruses, is whether they're computer viruses or physical viruses, is they don't respect hard borders. Climate change doesn't respect hard borders. Terrorists have found their way through and over hard borders. And we also need, to some extent, open borders in order to trade and attract tourism and do business and the like. So, again, the lesson is we've got to be discerning, but we can't assume our borders are going to, no matter how hard we may try to make them, there's no way borders or sovereignty provide you absolute protection. That's the beginning of wisdom here, is that we need responses to these challenges that goes way beyond the protection that our two oceans or borders provide us.
When you think of the global institutions that have done the most significant work in the past 75 years since the end of World War II, I think the transnational health initiatives are one that are top of my mind. Just when you think of the increases in life expectancy and overall improvement of global health. But certainly one criticism you pointed out is, seems to have played out in this pandemic, despite a lot of work and international agreements to prepare and monitor infectious disease outbreaks. And I should say the track record, even in the 21st century, is, you know, we stopped several major other threats in this century from becoming a pandemic. There's no overarching system in place. So what's your view on whether this pandemic will maybe spur an international system to play out for infectious diseases in the future?
Look, we'd all like to think that out of a crisis, there's opportunity. People will see the error of their ways and they will build a stronger set of global arrangements, be it to deal with future disease or with climate or with terror, you name it. Where we began the conversation, though, is also the possibility that people will learn different lessons. They'll be focused inwards. They'll be suspicious of others. And nothing's automatic here. But again, would I like that? Sure, I would like to see improved global health machinery, whether it's the World Health Organization or whether we create some new body or bodies to supplement what it does. But what we need is the capacity around the world to identify disease outbreaks if they happen, to try to contain them. You need reporting capabilities, the kind of thing that we have with the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. We want every country in the world to have them. Now, even that's not a solution because China has one. In this case, though, for political and economic reasons, they concealed much of what they knew for several weeks, or in some cases, they're still concealing some of what they knew. And I think that's a reality, that in a world of sovereign states, that governments will do what they believe is in their own self-interest, even if it proves it's not in their own self-interest, or even if it's not in the self-interest of other countries. So that's why we may need to think about supplementary arrangements. Where like-minded countries do certain things together, understanding that it won't include everybody.
Mm. So you see maybe more spheres of influence emerging again out of this?
Well, I hope not, because I don't like the idea of spheres of influence in a global world. Again, it seems to be something of a contradiction, and I don't want China to think it can do what it wants in its backyard, or Russia to do what it wants in its backyard, and I expect there are some countries in this part of the world that don't want us to have a free hand. No, I think what we're going to need are international institutions, but every institution may not have universal membership. You may end up having organizations that are simply made up of entities, including but not limited to countries, that are willing to do something, that are like-minded, that are relevant to the problem at hand. I mean, to give you an example, if we could get 10 or 12 or 15 of the largest emitters of greenhouse gases to agree on a climate initiative, okay, that's not 100% of the answer, but it may give you 80% of the answer, and 80% is better than 0%. And I take almost every issue in the world and say, if we can't get everybody to row in the same direction, then let's 50% or 70% of people to row, maybe over time we can attract the others. And it seems to me that might be a very pragmatic way to build international responses to international challenges. The big lesson is that we can't do it ourselves, that we can't, one, ignore these problems. Isolationism is a dead end. And two, unilateralism is not an attractive option. So we need to pay attention and we need partners. But the specific form these partnerships take, that I think we need to be creative and flexible about.
I just can hear all the naysayers saying 80% of the world is not 100% of the world on, say, a global climate initiative or, you know, and look, you look at what's happened in the last few weeks. I mean, there's always a look for demons, whether it's the World Health Organization, which you write in your chapter on global health, is really far from the monolithic organization I think most people think of when they think of the World Health Organization. It doesn't have a whole lot of authority.
No, most international organizations are only as strong as the member states allow it to be. You know, international organizations don't print money. They ultimately have to be supported by governments. The staff has to come from individual countries. So a country like China, in this case, has influence over the World Health Organization because it has to approve senior staff. It's got to provide some of the funding. So the World Health Organization is concerned that if it pushes back too hard against China, it will pay a price for it. Same thing is true of the United States. They're worried that if they alienate the United States, the difference is China's taken these institutions more seriously than we have. They've made them an area to compete for influence, and we've often avoided them. Again, we are more sometimes isolationist of late, certainly more unilateralist, and I think we've paid a price for that. So I'm hoping one of the lessons that emerges from this is that the United States has to be more involved in these institutions, not because they're perfect, but because they're not. And our goal should be to get involved and where we can leverage our support for changes that make these institutions more effective.
My guest today is Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's the author of a new book. It's a sort of a primer, if you will, on the world, which is the name of the book, The World, A Brief Introduction. And he's our guest today on Studio.
Oddly enough.
Yes, oddly enough. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I do want to ask one more question related to the pandemic, and that is the U.S. relationship with China. Certainly, during this presidential administration, our relationship has been perhaps more conflict-oriented than it has in the past, although there have always been conflicts between the U.S. and China. But out of this pandemic, do you see any changes in that relationship?
Well, you're right. It's a long, difficult history that goes back to the late 1940s, in some cases even before. Over the last couple of years, before the pandemic, the U.S.-Chinese relationship was worsening. We had real differences with China over their domestic repression in that country, over what they were doing militarily in the South China Sea, and so forth. We had, on the other hand, we were able to reach, you know, a limited trade agreement. The bottom line is the relationship was getting worse. Coming out of this, it'll be even worse. This is going to add more friction. A lot of Americans blame China. China ought to be blamed for the initial handling or mishandling of the disease outbreak. But at some point, we have to own up and take responsibility for our own performance. China's not responsible for our lack of protective equipment or for how badly we've handled testing. But I think the truth is that the U.S.-China relationship will be difficult coming out of this. My argument that I've made is that we need to, yes, push back against China on occasion, but we can't base American foreign policy on animosity towards China as we did, say, during the Cold War, and animosity towards the Soviet Union. There's too many things that China is ultimately not going to be the key to. We could succeed in pushing back against China, but that's not going to help us prevent future pandemics or deal with climate change or deal with terrorism, and I could come up with a long list. So competition with China is a reality. It's got to be part of what we deal with in the world, but it can't be the central focus.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book, The World. You wrote this book, as a sort of a primer on global literacy. Mm-hmm. What spurred that idea?
No, absolutely. The word primer is the one that comes to mind. What spurred it was a conversation I had one day with a young man who was about to become a senior at Stanford, getting his degree in computer sciences, and after a few seconds of talking with him, it became clear that he hadn't really taken many other courses outside of that field, and he wasn't going to have under his belt when he graduated a real appreciation or even a basic appreciation of history or economics or international relations. And when I got back to my office in New York and started looking at the requirements to graduate at America's university, it turned out that was pretty typical, that virtually every campus offers these courses, but virtually no campus, no school requires that you take them before you graduate. Most high schools don't offer these courses. You could watch the evening news most night, and you would come away with virtually no understanding of the world. So I was struck by this contradiction or gap between how important the world is in the 21st century to Americans of every age and how little most knew about this world that they were living in and in some cases were going to enter. So I decided that I would try to write in one readable, accessible, relatively short volume. Here's not everything you need to know, but here's at least the foundation. Here's the basics to help you become a better informed citizen and to make some better choices, either who you vote for or what you do in terms of your business, your investment, your own life. It was my effort to provide people a floor or a foundation on which to approach the world.
Before we talk about some of the things you felt were essential to know, what about this essential argument that, you know, as our world has become more specialized, we don't get a general broad education in, say, the liberal arts, if you will, and that means history, economics, political science, you know, a whole range of fields.
Yeah, I'm worried about that, and I think it's essential. That's what education does. I would say education needs to give people critical skills, critical thinking, writing, speaking, reading, what have you, ability to work with others. And what do we want as Americans? I'd say, one, we want our young people also to have a real appreciation for American democracy. So we transmit our DNA from generation to generation, our political DNA. And we also want Americans to have a real understanding of this world they're going to enter that's going to affect their lives. Specific things, other things, in many cases, I actually think you can learn as you go through life on the job. But I want every citizen to have the basic skills, an understanding of our politics, and an understanding of the world. And I would hope that parents, whether it's with school boards or universities, would start demanding this. You know, we're all paying for our education, whether it's through taxes or through the fees we pay to schools. And I just think this ought to be part of the mix that every student graduates with.
Well, you begin with an essential history that begins with the conclusion of the 30 Years' War to go up to the present day, and then you sort of go through each region of the world and tell a little bit more about each region of the world. But I was you make a sound argument for why starting your history at the conclusion of the 30 Years' War. Why that starting point?
I thought a lot about it, and I just decided that if I had to choose a point in history to explain how we got to where we are today, here we are two decades into the 21st century, it was the rise of a world in which countries, often used the word states, became the most important entity. Up to that, it was largely kingdoms or principalities, like what today is Germany or today is Italy, where hundreds of small, tiny little principalities or fiefdoms. The emergence of major countries, to me, this was the beginning of, or the rise of powerful countries that had real access to large amounts of economics, that could govern their people's lives, could go to war on a large scale. But also at that time was born the idea of sovereignty, the idea that countries would respect the boundaries, the borders of other countries, and wouldn't constantly be at war with one another. So this was the rise of these powerful entities, but also with some new rules about how they would behave toward one another. And if you then look at the last few hundred years, this is the beginning. This is the basis of modern history, and we're still dealing with some of these consequences. We still live in a world, for example, where borders are meant to be recognized or respected, and unwritten or at times written rules, but they're not always obeyed or respected, is that we ought not to change these borders by force. Every once in a while, we see that somebody does, most recently, say, Russia in Ukraine. But by and large, this basis of international relations, which we still live with and benefit from today, goes back a few hundred years.
You listed a whole set of challenges in this global era, from globalization itself to terrorism to nuclear proliferation, climate change, migration, cybersecurity and cyberspace, and of course, global health. We're all concentrating on global health right now, but what is the, I mean, you're hearing a lot of talk about climate change in conjunction with this pandemic, where you begin to see skies clearing when everything in India and in China with the shutdown of societies. What's the biggest challenge in your view for these next 20, 30 years as far as these sets of challenges that are out there?
They're all big, whether it's regulating behavior in cyberspace, dealing with terrorism. But if I had to choose one, it would be climate change. And just as an aside, the air is a bit clearer because essentially we have a recession or worse going on. People aren't working. Factories are closed. But mercifully, that will be temporary, and then people will start driving their cars and go back to work, and things will get dirty again in India and China, parts of the United States. And none of that is really about climate change. That's simply about the quality of the air and the environment. Climate change is much bigger. It's much more fundamental. It's about the warming up of the atmosphere and the oceans and all the changes that sets in motion. And I'm just worried if we don't get this under control, and there's no signs yet that we are, the kinds of fires and floods and storms that have so disrupted life in this country, Australia, and elsewhere will become worse and worse, more frequent and more severe. And that will talk about changing life as we know it. The pandemic is one thing that's changed life as we know it. Climate change on a grand scale would also change life as we know it. And I just simply don't want that to come to pass.
I know it's a small part of the overall CO2 emissions, but personal cars, one of the things that may be left in the wake of the pandemic is the avoidance of public transit for a long time, where you will rely on personal transportation as opposed to public transportation, be it air travel, train travel, subway travel, what have you, which could actually worsen the problem in the short term.
You're quite right. It'd be a long time before people are going to be comfortable getting into tin cans that are airplanes or getting into an Uber or a taxi cab. One of the things that I would say is, it's controversial, but if we're going to give billions of dollars to automobile companies to get them through this crisis, which we should, then I would argue we should condition it that, among other things, when they start rebuilding cars, those cars meet much higher fuel efficiency standards. I think there's a way to get the economy going again in a way that's responsible and does what also needs doing in terms of the environment. The idea that there's this trade-off that if we want to do what's good for the economy, we have to let the environment deteriorate even more is just dead wrong. We can be responsible on climate change and get people back to work again. And we also, right now, we have the opportunity to do that on a large scale in a way that we would not have had without this pandemic, this sudden stoppage of the economy and our desire to restart it using trillions of dollars of money coming out of the federal government gives us opportunities to restructure things, and we should take advantage of it.
My guest today is Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's the author of The World, A Brief Introduction. Well, as I mentioned, your book is a series of views of the world as you perceive it, with no policy prescriptions or no viewpoints of the world as you would like to see it, which often goes along with a book of this sort. Why did you write it in that way, where there's no, here's the way it works, and maybe it might work better this way? Why did you not go in that route?
For a couple of reasons, but you're right to notice it. I tried to keep away from policy recommendations because, in part, I wanted this to be a primer, to use the word that you used, that would be acceptable to everybody. I didn't want to lose potential readers because they disagreed with this or that policy or recommendation or prescription. I've written or edited 14 other books, And I've had lots of other places to make arguments for what the United States ought to do in the world and how we ought to react to this or that challenge, and I will again. But I wanted this to be more of an educational book. I wanted it to be an evergreen one that would last and, again, provide a floor of knowledge, of understanding, so then people would be in a better position to make up their own minds about what they think about trade or tariffs or sanctions or climate change or what have you. I'd say the only two real biases in the book, policy-wise, but they're more almost attitudinal, is one that isolationism is a dead end, that we can run but we can't hide from the world. And second of all, there's almost nothing we can do in the world better by ourselves than with partners and allies. So I do believe in multilateralism. But what form that multilateralism takes and what specific policies it wraps itself around, that's, again, a matter for debate. I just wanted to get people to the point where they could participate in the debates, be more informed, be more aware. I don't want to tell them what to think. I wanted to give them the tools so they could reach better decisions for themselves.
Right now, the United States seems to be pursuing at least two of those aims, unilateralism and, to a lesser extent, isolationism. Do you think that's a temporary way of viewing the world right now for the United States?
It's a good question, and I don't have the answer. I sure hope it's temporary because I think both are dangerous. I think both will leave us much worse off. So that's also in part what motivated me to write this book, that I wanted to make sure that people understood the dangers, even the folly, to use a strong word, of isolationism. You know, the image I always have is one of the ostrich sticking its head in the sand, and then the tide's going to come in and wash that ostrich away. So I don't want us to be the proverbial ostrich. Again, I do think there's real limits to not just opting out, but to unilateralism. So I can't answer your question, but both those tendencies are strong. And what I wanted to do was make people realize the limits to thinking of the world in those terms.
The name of the book is The World, A Brief Introduction. Dr. Haas, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Dr. Richard Haas is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. His latest book, The World, A Brief Introduction, is a primer on the history and issues confronting contemporary world affairs, and is published by Penguin Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.